Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with host Hal Shurtleff. The show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and also heard on IPMNation.org Saturday afternoons at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it's brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-and-a-day-long family camp. We have the Sam Blumenfeld Archives. He was a good friend of Camp Constitution and left us his library. We've been able to upload a lot of his materials, including his Alpha Phonics with all 128 lessons in video and audio, and many other things. This show is also put up on YouTube, so please visit our YouTube channel and subscribe to it, Camp Constitution, and visit us on Facebook. Well, I have my co-host, I think, is out there, Jack McCarthy. Jack, you there?
Well, this is Ed Griffin that got on the line, maybe by
accident. All right, well, I got Ed Griffin. Ed is my guest. And Ed, I want to first, let me introduce you to the listeners. Ed is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, that many of his books. I think his first book was at The Fearful Master, A Second Look at the UN, back in the early 60s when you were a little bit younger. You have appeared in dozens of documentaries, including From Freedom to Fascism, and I think, was it Indoctrination as well? That was a more recent one. I think you were in that one. The Agenda. You have your own. You're also the author of A World Without Cancer, which was an incredible book exposing the medical mafia, as I call it. So, Ed, thank you so much for being on. It's a real delight to have you on.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I have no idea what we're going to talk about today.
Well, there's not much to talk about. You've only written about 15 books and sort of the cutting edge of many, many topics. You may not remember.
Suggestions.
Okay, well, we get Jack McCarthy as my co-host. Jack had talked to me about a topic that, of course, dealing with the Federal Reserve Bank. But I interviewed you. You did a book tour. I think it was your very first book tour on Creature from Jekyll Island. I think it was 1994, and I interviewed you in a cable TV station in Wakefield, Massachusetts. A gentleman from South Dakota actually rented the studio, who had a bookstore in those days, and we did a one-hour interview, and you said you liked it, and you're sort of a stickler for getting things right, so I was very pleased with that. And I finally found a whole hour of it, which is up on our Camp Constitution YouTube channel. Both of us are a little bit younger, but you haven't aged much, Ed.
Thank you for that.
tell us a little bit about, I want to focus on your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and the concept of sound money. So introduce the book to the listeners and what motivated you to write the book and the responses you've received over the years.
Oh, boy, that's the big the big bathtub full there, isn't it? Well, let's just start with what motivated me to write about it. Back in those days, I was trying to bootstrap myself into the documentary film industry. I had no money at all, of course, so that's where the bootstrap comes in. So in those days, when we put together some kind of a program like that, it was very similar to what we call PowerPoint today, just a bunch of still pictures for the most part, and your commentary was recorded, and every time a still picture needed to be moved from one to the next, there was a beep on the soundtrack.
Beeping sound, yeah.
Yeah, somebody at the projector would turn the knob and up would come the next film. Okay, that's what we were doing. And I wanted to do one of those on the subject of inflation. Okay, well, I didn't know much about inflation, except I knew there was something hokey going on there, because everybody was blaming someone else for the cause of inflation. There was a lot of discussion as to why are we having inflation. And the general impression in those days was that somebody in the food chain was making too much money. Like, mm-hmm. if you went to the grocery store and the price of bread went up, it was customary for the housewife to say, oh, the grocery store is raising their prices. They're making too much money. And, of course, the grocery store managers would say, well, it's not us. It's the cost of labor. I mean, these darn employees keep striking, and they want more and more wages. We can't afford it unless we increase the price of bread. And then the labor unions would say, well, it's not us. We're just trying to keep up with inflation. We're just trying to, you know, make sure that what we earned this year is buys the same we did last year. It's really those guys that deliver the food to the stores, the truck drivers. And the truck driver says, no, no, it's the food suppliers, it's the wholesalers. And the wholesaler said, no, those darn farmers are getting too much money for their product, and so forth. And I knew there was something really hokey about that. So I started to gather some information about it. And I thought, I'll do a little documentary. This should be interesting. I really didn't know what the cause of inflation was in those days. Well, I soon discovered that the engine of inflation was this thing called the Federal Reserve. It was the creation that, the political and commercial creation. It was actually a cartel. We'll talk about that perhaps in a moment. But I knew that they created money and somehow had to do with supply and demand. Well, to make a long story short, I never did produce that documentary. Other things got in the way. But some years later, I had a chance to address a small group of people on the subject of taxes. And I didn't know much about taxes except that they were too high and I was a ginnum. But that's about all you can say is that taxes are too high. And, well, in one sense, they're not high enough because we keep going into debt. So we're not charging enough taxes for the things the government buys. Otherwise, we wouldn't go into debt. So if you take that argument, you say, well, no, taxes are too low. But that's another issue has to do with political restraint and the proper role of the state and all of that. So I was just concerned with, well, how come this money supply was creating and being created? And I gave a talk on what I called the hidden tax called inflation. Mm-hmm. Well, it made a big hit, and I was encouraged to go on the road with it. So I did. I gave some seminars called the Crash Course on Money, and everybody thought I was an expert because I knew two or three things that they didn't.
That's right.
Yeah, it was embarrassing because at the end of these lectures, people would approach me and say, well, you know, Mr. Griffin, what should I do with my savings? You know, I'm retired now and my husband has passed away. And should I go into debt and buy real estate, or should I get out of debt? Should I buy gold or silver? And, you know, I had to look at myself in the mirror and say I was a complete fraud because I didn't know the answers to those questions. I just knew how money came into creation. So I quit all that, pretending like I knew something, and I went to school. I got a certificate as a certified financial planner. I never wanted to become a financial planner, but I did want to know what these people knew about the real markets. Then after that was over, I started to write my book, and when it was all done, it was a 7-year passage. And I can just tell you that had I known up front how much I didn't know and had to learn and the stuff I had to go through, I would never have been able to take that journey all the way to the end. So thank God I was so ignorant and stupid at the beginning. It was one of the best things I ever did.
The book Creature from Jekyll Island, tell listeners a little bit about what is this Jekyll Island? Sounds like some kind of some Class B horror movie.
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons I chose that title, because I thought it might attract attention, you know. I thought people might think this had something to do with, like, Jurassic Park Part 2 or something. But no, Jekyll Island is a real island, and it was off the coast of Georgia that the Federal Reserve System actually was conceived back in 1910. It's a historic, of great historic significance, because the creators of the Fed wanted to escape the prying eyes of the press. They wanted to go someplace where they could talk quite openly, not be observed. And so they went to this private island called Jekyll Island. In those days, it was completely owned by a small group of billionaires from New York. We're talking about people like, you know, J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business associates. They're really super wealthy, and they owned little private estates there. They owned the whole island. It was a private club. They called it the Jekyll Island Club. And so that's where they went. They hammered together the Federal Reserve System. And what they created was a cartel. It was a banking cartel. Not much different, in fact, no different really than a banana cartel or an oil cartel. It was just a banking cartel where they brought together all of the competing big banking interests and said, okay, guys, we're not going to compete with each other anymore. And we know that the public is clamoring for a congressional control over our banking industry, and we don't want that. So rather than fight it, we'll just take the lead in that movement, and we will clamor for control, and we'll get the control over our own industry and write the rules and regs so it favors us. and doesn't really help the people at all. So that's basically what they did. They drafted this cartel agreement on Jekyll Island, and they came back to Washington, D.C., and if you can put in your mind a giant eraser, they erased the words from the top of the paper that said cartel agreement, and they wrote in the words Federal Reserve Act. And they passed it into law in 1913, and we've been living under that cartel agreement as law ever since. And that, in a nutshell, is what the Federal Reserve is all about.
Now, you mentioned in the book, you mentioned one of the attendees at this this Jekyll Island meeting, Frank Vanderlip. And shortly before his death, he wrote his autobiography, From Farm Boy to Financier. Well, a friend of mine found a copy of that book, which is very hard to find. It's listed on Amazon for like $2,000. He paid a dollar for it at a yard sale.
Wow.
And you also pointed out that book was serialized in the Saturday Evening Post.
Yes.
And he found the magazine that had that article in it, and we actually, Camp Constitution Press, reprinted that particular chapter. I don't think Mr. Vanderlip will take any exception. But in the article, he basically said we were secretive as any conspirator.
That's right. Yeah, there was no secret about it. Of course, don't forget that article was published long after the Federal Reserve was actually passed into law. And because at the time, there was great secrecy around that meeting. They denied that they were going to the meeting. They were told that when they arrived in the New Jersey Railroad Station to board Senator Aldrich's private railroad car to make that trip up to Jekyll Island, that they had to come one by one, not to be seen together, not to talk to newspaper reporters and all of that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of secrecy about that meeting. And so they denied when the rumors were circulating that there was a meeting and people were asking, what's going on, all you big top bankers? And they said, no, nothing like that happened. And then finally said, well, yeah, we had a meeting. We went to shoot some ducks. It was a duck hunting trip. And so they kept, you know, lying about it. And then afterwards, after the Federal Reserve was passed into law and had gradually become revered as a great American institution, people thought of it then and still do as like a government agency, then the word came out and they began to admit. They said, yeah, we went there. That's what we did, all right. And then it was really funny, I thought, as I dug deeper into this, because some of these guys actually began to puff out their chests. And it seemed like a contest to see who would claim the most credit for being there and directing the meeting. And you find that in these articles that you're talking about, that some of them wrote, and some of them had biographies written about them. And you find this change in attitude very revealing, from utter secrecy to kind of a competition between them for credit.
Don't you find it interesting that history doesn't just happen? That the people knew intrinsically that they did not want a central bank. So the central bankers got a non-banker to introduce it to Congress, and then the people said, oh, isn't this nice?
Well, that's the way they always work it. And, the descriptives that were put out around that legislation were always about controlling the banks, you know. The money interests and the cartels, and everybody was saying, we've got to control these people. And so that was the kind of literature and the rhetoric that surrounded the Federal Reserve Act. And just because people were saying it, the average voter assumed that it was true. Nothing has changed, really, because
we had to prevent at all costs another depression.
Yeah. Now, of course, that what was set in motion was the guarantee that there would be a huge future depression. So, yeah, it's all hocus pocus. It's political nonsense or criminality, I guess you would call it. I would. It's hard to remain dignified when you're talking about these things and avoid using harsh words because after a while, you know, you want to start shouting obscenities at this whole thing.
In one of your many speeches, you made reference to gold and silver, and I think you said something to the effect that 2,000 years ago, you could buy a pair of sandals and a toga and a cloak for about an ounce of silver, and today, with a $20 gold piece, you could probably buy a nice pair of shoes, a pretty decent suit and a shirt and a tie. So the value of the gold hasn't changed a whole lot. It's just the money that the inflationary currency is out there is the issue.
Yeah, that is probably one of the two or three main issues to be derived from this whole topic, is a better understanding of what money is, or perhaps we should turn it around, what money should be compared to what it is. And I was just going to say in summary that most people want their money to be a storehouse of value. A storehouse of value, that's the critical word, so that if they have a $20 bill or a $100 bill today, they think that 10 years down the line, it still have purchasing power of what it has today. And that always happens when the money is backed by something like gold or silver, something that takes human effort to produce. But once you separate money away from something that takes human effort, and it just becomes created by political whim, just by raising your hand and saying, oh yeah, let's create another $1 billion today and put it in circulation. Once that happens, then it's history always shows that the gates are open. You can't keep the cattle in the yard, and the gates are open, and they start creating money far more and far more rapidly than the creation of goods and services. So it doesn't take long before money is everywhere, but the goods and services are still pretty limited, which means that the prices seem to go up. But what is really happening is the value of the money is going down.
And if so people could just wrap their brain around that concept, that the prices did not go up, the value of their currency went down.
The wage
wasn't improved if you don't control the currency.
And that is the primary reason that banking cartels or anybody interested in making a killing at the expense of somebody else, that's the reason they want to have control over the issuance of the money supply. And that's the reason they all hate with a passion gold or silver or anything else of tangible value as a limit to the money. They hate it because that means that they themselves cannot create it out of nothing. And that's the legality of creating money out of nothing. And if that isn't counterfeit, I don't know. The legality of that is the holy grail for all of the bankers of the world.
And you pointed out, too, that when a bank creates this money out of thin air, say $1,000, they're actually creating 10 times that. Reserves.
Yes, it's an amazing process. It's a little bit complicated, but at first it seems that way, but it's really pretty simple. Yeah, the Federal Reserve creates money as a loan to the federal government or to anybody who wants to buy one of their bonds. Okay, and those assets are then put into banks, and then the banks say, we have an asset. Here's a bond, a federal bond, a government bond. Let's say it's a bond worth $1,000. Now we can use that and loan up to $10,000, or let's say $9,000, and still hold $1,000 in the bank. Well, they've only got $1,000, so they just create the additional $9,000 and put it out in the form of a loan. So you see, it's created first of all by the Federal Reserve when they create credits or securities against loans, primarily to the federal government and or to other governments, whatever. But then the real action takes place is when that first wave of money comes into the local banks, the commercial banking system, and they use that first wave of money as a so-called reserve to create 10 times more out of nothing. So it's a two-step process. And the real action takes place at the local level, at the level of the local banks. That's why we have to keep in mind that the Federal Reserve is a banking cartel. It's made up of banks, many banks, and they're all part of it. They're happy to be in it because they have now legalized that process where they can create money out of nothing and charge interest on nothing.
It makes Bernie Madoff look like a street beggar.
He's just a little kid in the sandbox making a fight. Yeah,
stealing kids' lunch money.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of talk about who actually owns the Federal Reserve Bank, and you know, you'll hear the Queen of England or the Rothschilds or this group or that group. And I know you address it in the book, but could you address it now? I know you've got about 15 We got 10 minutes left, but if you could try to explain who actually owns the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, well, there are two ways of looking at it. The first way that most people look at it is who owns the shares of the ownership, you know, the stock. Well, remember, the Federal Reserve is a cartel. It's not a single organization. It has members. It's owned by the members. So who are the members? Well, the members are the banks. Like any cartel or corporation, for that matter, with a lot of stockholders, the ones with the most stock are the ones that control. So in the Federal Reserve, the largest banks are the ones that control. The little ones, yeah, technically they have some ownership, but no, they're outweighed by the clout of the really big banks. And so for all practical purposes, you always look at a cartel and say, who are the major players? If it's an oil cartel, you know, which countries have the most oil and so forth. Same thing in the banking cartel. So we're looking at two or possibly three major banks. And you recognize them, of course. In the beginning, these were all Rockefeller banks and Morgan banks and that kind of thing. And now there's Citibank, Bank of America, and so forth. So that's how it looks on the books. But now it's a little more complex than that because, you know, ownership really, the test of ownership in the form of a stock is not what we have with the Federal Reserve. If you bought some shares in General Motors, for example, you say, I own these shares, and therefore I am an owner, part owner of General Motors, but one of my tests of ownership is that I can sell my stock if I want to. So if you own something, you ought to be able to sell it. Well, the banks cannot sell their stocks. They're stuck with it. They're the only ones that can own it. So it's not really a stock ownership at all. It's a certificate of participation, but they call it a stock. You can't sell it. It has no voting right. You can't select your board of directors. It's just sort of for show. It's just to make it look like it has some kind of participation by all the little people involved. When you really get down to the nitty-gritties, it's a question of who controls these banks, and that's sort of done behind closed doors. There are meetings that take place that we don't know anything about. The Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, for example, is where a lot of this action goes on. But still, even though we don't know the exact mechanism, it's clear that the countries with the largest economic holdings, with the largest trade, with the largest activity, with the largest number of dollars, so to speak, they're the ones who are the bulls that pull the weight. The United States is clearly the first one in that bunch. The U.S. controls it, regardless of who owns those stock certificates at all. It makes no difference. It's who are the biggest holders. And now the third way of looking at this is the idea that even if you could find that there are foreign interests, like, let's say, the Rothschilds or foreign holdings that have undue influence through their stock ownership in the Federal Reserve, the idea is, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. Let's get rid of all these foreigners, get them out, and turn this over to the Treasury. That's usually how the argument goes, you know. Get it out of stock ownership and turn it over to the government. Now, that'll solve the problem, won't it? You know, as though those trustworthy politicians that we elect are far better than those dirty, bad bankers. Well, you haven't really solved the problem if you're just looking totally on who owns these things. What we have to do is what they do, what they're empowered to do. As long as they're legalized to create money out of nothing, I don't care who owns them. We're going to have the same problem.
So legal versus lawful.
Yeah, legal versus lawful. If you authorize someone to steal legally, they're going to steal legally. I don't care who they are.
Hello, Hitler.
Well,
everything he did was legal.
Of course. That's what slays me when I hear someone like a former President Bush, number one at the UN, said, well, we're going to create a world, you know, rule of law. I'm thinking to myself, yeah, rule of law. Whose law? You know,
Luck with that.
Yeah, good luck with that. The criminals and the totalitarians always have rule of law, so that's not it.
Hal, can I ask
go ahead, yes.
A question?
Go ahead, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I've been working on this for like 5-6 years. It's been driving me crazy. I just think I figured it out yesterday morning. In your opinion, how does the state, the several sovereign states, get around Article 1, Section 10, that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin tender in payment of debt?
Well, let me stop and think about that. All they have to do, they don't have to get around it. They just have to follow it. I think any state is perfectly legalized, has the right to issue a state gold or silver coin and say that's legal tender within the state. They can't force other states to do that or to accept their legal tender coins. But I think it'd be a very good thing if they did, because sooner
or
later.
But it's the law. But it's the law. No state shall cause anything but federal gold or silver coins to be used as tender in payment of debt. The state cannot use anything, cannot spend or take in anything but gold or silver coin.
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying now. Well, so the state can use gold and silver coin as a...
Right.
Yeah, that's it.
No, the state shall. The state is not allowed to use anything else. No state, Article 1, Section 10, no state shall make or cause anything but gold or silver coin to be used as tender in payment of debt. I'll tell you how they got around it.
Oh, well, they said no state can do it, but they didn't say that the federal government couldn't do it.
Right. But how does the state function if it can't use anything but gold or silver coin as tender in payment of debt? That's the law. Never been amended.
Yeah, I guess we probably should get some constitutional attorney in here. But I think the way the court ruled on that was that they were talking about legal and tender for the nation, for the United States, as opposed to locally. But I don't know.
Section 10 also says that states can't coin their own money, because at
right.
one time they used to. Yeah.
Right. So okay, so the Federal Reserve, your favorite subject, when they started printing Federal Reserve notes, there's a disclaimer on every Federal Reserve note that was the same up until the mid-50s. No, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at any Federal Reserve Bank or the United States Treasury. Well, that was cool.
Yeah, that's
but
cool.
In the 50s, they erased the second line. This note is now legal tender for all debts, public and private. When they got us used to it for 40 years of using Federal Reserve notes, then they just erased. No law change. They just erased the bottom line.
Yeah.
And then, so between the 50s and the early 60s, all the bills printed replaced all the old bills, and so there was no more this note may be replaced or redeemable in lawful money. And then in August of 1971, they knew, because this didn't happen in a vacuum. It didn't just progress. This was a plan. In 1971, Nixon pulled the trigger on the gold window, and now those states had it out. They could say that they were using Federal Reserve notes because they were redeemable in lawful money, were in compliance with the Article 1, Section 10. But since August of 71, they're not.
We only have about a half a minute left. Ed, can you give the listeners a way they can reach you? You have a website, your organization,
yeah.
and some of your material, your books and DVDs.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. Thanks for that. First of all, I'll tout my little commercial site where we have books and recordings on all of this, where you'll find the creature from Jekyll Island and other things. In fact, 100 other items. It's called Reality Zone. So it's realityzone.com. Now, we have another place where we do a lot of thinking and discussions of what are we going to do about this problem. And it's a think tank. We have nothing to sell there except ideas. And they don't cost anything. They just come and learn about them. And that's Freedom Force International. That's freedomforceinternational.org. So those are the two places, and you can find me at both of them. So the information is at Reality Zone, and the strategies and tactics for what to do about it is found at freedomforceinternational.org.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much for being a guest, and Jack for being a co-host. Folks, you've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio on WBCQ The Planet. Until next week, God bless, and good night.